Anderson.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From Belém, Brazil, the gateway to the Amazon, we're at COP30, the UN Climate Summit. This is Democracy Now!
I leave to Brasilia certain that my negotiators will achieve the best result that a COP can ever offer to planet Earth.
As climate negotiations continue here in Belém, Brazil, we'll speak to Sonia Guajajara, Brazil's first Indigenous Peoples Minister.
Are expecting the recognition of indigenous territories and the demarcation of these territories as a climate policy, one of the most efficient solutions to confront the climate crisis.
We will also look at how climate disasters have displaced 250 million people over the past decade. That's nearly 70,000 people a day. Then, is the Amazon rainforest being pushed beyond the tipping point? We'll speak with world-renowned Brazilian climatologist Carlos Nobre. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military has killed at least 32 Palestinians in a wave of attacks that once again violated the October ceasefire deal with Hamas. Among the dead are at least 10 people, including an entire family, killed when Israel bombed a building sheltering displaced Palestinians in Gaza City's Zeitoun neighborhood. Israel said it launched the attacks after its soldiers came under fire. Hamas rejected the claim and noted Israel said none of its troops were wounded in the alleged attack. In Khan Yunis, family and friends held funerals earlier today for victims of Israeli attacks on southern Gaza.
They say there's a ceasefire. Where is this ceasefire they're talking about? Where are the guarantors of the ceasefire? Every day, 10, 15, 20 martyrs die. We wake up to martyrs, and we go to sleep to martyrs, and they say there's a ceasefire. Unfortunately, there is no ceasefire.
According to Al Jazeera, Israel's violated the ceasefire agreement at least 393 times since October 10th. Meanwhile, the charity Save the Children reports explosive weapons caused a record number of child deaths and injuries last year when nearly 12,000 children were killed or wounded in conflicts worldwide. It's the highest toll since records began in 2006, driven largely by Israel's more than two-year assault on Gaza, where more than 20,000 children have been killed, an average of one child per hour dead since October 2023. Syria's government's denounced a visit by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Syrian territory occupied for months by Israeli forces. The territory extends Israel's grip on the occupied Golan Heights. Syria's UN ambassador called Netanyahu's visit with Israeli soldiers a, quote, provocative tour which epitomizes Israel's ongoing aggression against Syria and its people, unquote. Meanwhile, an investigation by The Guardians found Israeli forces used cluster munitions that are widely banned under international law during its recent 13-month war in Lebanon. Photos published by The Guardian show remnants of two different types of Israeli cluster munitions found in three areas of southern Lebanon left devastated by Israeli attacks that have killed almost 4,000 people. The weapons are banned by 124 states that signed the Convention on Cluster Munitions, though Israel and the United States are not signatories. Russia launched a wave of missile and drone attacks on Ukraine Wednesday that killed at least 26 people, including three children. 93 others were wounded in the attacks, many of which targeted the western city of Ternopil, where missiles struck residential high-rise buildings. This is Oksana Kobel, the mother of a man who disappeared behind a wall of flames triggered by the Russian strikes.
My son is still in the apartment on the ninth floor. I talked to him before the explosions. That's it. He said, "Mom, everything will be fine. Don't worry." After this, I tried calling and couldn't reach him. I still know nothing.
Russia's latest attacks came as Axios reported U.S. and Russian officials quietly drafted a plan to end the war in Ukraine that would see Kyiv agree to surrender territory to Russia while cutting the size of Ukraine's armed forces. European officials pushed back against the plan, with France's foreign minister declaring, quote, "Peace cannot be a capitulation." Meanwhile, Ukrainian lawmakers have fired two government ministers accused of taking part in a $100 million kickback scheme within the state-owned nuclear power company. President Trump signed a bill Wednesday compelling the Justice Department to release files from its investigation into the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. This comes after a near unanimous vote in the House and Senate ordering the DOJ to release the Epstein files. Attorney General Pam Bondi confirmed the DOJ will release the files within 30 days, but hinted the Justice Department may cite ongoing investigations or other reasons to hold back material. On Wednesday, a Republican effort to censure the Democratic delegate from the Virgin Islands, Stacey Plaskett, failed on the House floor. Documents from Epstein's estate released last week show Plaskett was exchanging texts with Epstein during a 2019 congressional hearing. Meanwhile, former Harvard president, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, announced he's stepping down from commitments at Harvard and from the board of OpenAI after documents showed he continued to stay in touch with Jeffrey Epstein long after Epstein's 2008 sex trafficking conviction. Emails show Summers called Epstein his wingman and asked for advice on pursuing a sexual relationship with a much younger woman he called his mentee. Harvard has opened an investigation into Summers' actions. Hundreds of protesters took to the streets of Charlotte, North Carolina, Wednesday as Border Patrol agents continued to target Latinx communities, with over 250 immigrants reportedly arrested in recent days. This is Renee Tillett, a resident of Fort Mill, South Carolina, who joined the protests.
I feel it's important that we're out here, not sitting at home on our butts, quiet about what's going on. If you're not seeing something and saying something, you're complicit. I do not want to be complicit. What's going on here is illegal, it's warrantless, and people are getting picked up without proper identification, without warrants, and that is wrong. Doesn't matter who you are, that is wrong. We need to support our immigrants. We love our immigrants here in Charlotte.
This week, the Border Patrol expanded its North Carolina operations to include the heavily Democratic Research Triangle region, which includes Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill. Meanwhile, in Chicago, new data reported by the Chicago Tribune finds 97% of immigrants detained in the Trump administration's Operation Midway Blitz had no criminal conviction, according to federal court records. The Justice Department admitted Wednesday members of a grand jury never voted on the final criminal indictment against former FBI Director James Comey. The admission came as a federal judge in Virginia grilled Trump's hand-picked interim U.S. attorney, Lindsey Halligan, his former private attorney, over her procedural missteps, which many legal scholars say could result in her losing her bar license. Comey's lawyers have asked the court to dismiss his case on the grounds he's the target of a vindictive prosecution led by President Trump. In Florida, a man who joined the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol has been arrested on multiple charges that he sexually abused children. 44-year-old Andrew Paul Johnson pleaded not guilty to charges he molested a child as young as 11 years old. He joins a growing number of Capitol rioters who face new legal problems after they were pardoned by President Trump on Trump's first day back in office. The House of Representatives voted unanimously Wednesday to rescind a provision of the recently passed spending bill that would allow 8 Republican senators to personally sue the government for up to $1 million each if their phone records were seized as part of Special Counsel Jack Smith's investigation into the January 6th attack. Maryland Democrat Congressmember Jamie Raskin called the measure one of the most blatantly corrupt provisions for political self-dealing and the plunder of public resources ever proposed in Congress, unquote. It's not clear whether the bill to repeal the language will get a vote in the Senate. President Trump set to meet with New York City Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani at the White House Friday. Trump announced the meeting in a post on social media calling Mamdani a communist. During the mayoral campaign, Trump had backed Mamdani's opponent, the disgraced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, and repeatedly taunted Mamdani and threatened to deport him. Mamdani was born in Uganda and is a naturalized U.S. citizen. Mamdani's team had reportedly reached out to President Trump for the meeting. Here in Belém, Brazil, at COP30, a big issue emerging in the climate negotiations is whether countries will agree to a roadmap to transition away from fossil fuels. Now more than 80 countries, including Germany, Kenya, and Britain, are backing the proposal, but that's less than half of all countries attending the summit. This is Harjeet Singh, a member of the Fossil Fuel Treaty Initiative, who joined protests here at COP30 on Wednesday.
We want this particular COP30 to deliver a roadmap on fossil fuel phase out, to have a just transition plan so that we can all move away from fossil fuels and go more and more towards renewable energy. But the fossil fuel lobbyists are not allowing us to do that. Developed countries who are responsible for the climate crisis, they are not providing money. And without climate finance, we cannot protect our people, we cannot move away from fossil fuels.
Meanwhile, Turkey has emerged as the host of next year's COP31 climate summit, which will be held in the Mediterranean port city of Antalya, while Australia is set to lead the conference's negotiations. We'll have more from the UN climate summit here in Belém, Brazil, after headlines. And the Trump administration is proposing to significantly weaken protections under the Endangered Species Act with new rules that would allow for more oil drilling, logging, and mining in habitats for endangered species in the U.S. One of the proposed rules would enable the government to consider economic factors before deciding whether to list a species as endangered. Another rule would reduce the requirements for other federal agencies to consult with wildlife agencies on whether their actions could harm critical habitats. Jane Davenport, a senior attorney at Defenders of Wildlife, said the new rules could, quote, accelerate the extinction crisis we face today, unquote. An investigation by the Montana Free Press found the Endangered Species Act has prevented 291 species from going extinct since it was passed in 1973. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit, COP30, in the Brazilian city of Belém, the gateway to the Amazon. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show with rising calls by the United Nations to enact stronger protections for refugees and migrants forcibly displaced by climate disasters. In a new report, the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees estimates about 250 million people, predominantly in the global south, have been forced from their homes in the last decade due to deadly droughts, storms, floods, and extreme heat. That's more than 67,000 displacements a day. Many of these populations have faced repeated displacement due to war and extreme poverty, with UN experts saying 3 in 4 of those who've been uprooted now live in countries where communities are vulnerable to, quote, high to extreme exposure to climate-related dangers. In countries like Chad, refugee camps are likely to become uninhabitable by 2050 as extreme weather worsens, according to the UN. This comes as wealthier global north nations, which are disproportionately responsible for the climate crisis, have intensified their crackdown on migrants and climate refugees fleeing compounding humanitarian crises. At the U.S.-Mexico border, many of these migrants come from regions devastated by the climate crisis and destructive industries, including mining, driven by foreign powers.
On Wednesday, Democracy Now! Spoke to Edwin Josue Castellanos López, Guatemala's Vice Minister of Natural Resources and Climate Change, about Guatemala's role in ensuring the United States respects the human rights of migrant communities.
It is definitely a very complex situation, and we are just trying to work as much as possible with the U.S. government to make sure that they treat our citizens in the best way possible. It is difficult because they are, of course, interested in making sure that no more people go to the U.S., but we need to find a midway solution. We need to make sure that our people have the opportunities that they need. Many of these migrants are probably related to climate issues, but of course the main issue is always poverty, lack of opportunities, and climate change is basically exacerbating this problem.
That was Guatemala's Vice Minister of Natural Resources and Climate Change speaking to Democracy Now!'s Maria Inez Taracena. For more, we're joined by Nikki Reich, Director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for International Environmental Law. We want to talk about climate refugees around the world. But first, you are a leader in these negotiations and understanding what's going on. If you can explain, what are the sticking points at this point? It's unusual that the president of the country, President Lula, has come back to the climate summit at this early point. What are they negotiating over? And what is stopping them from moving forward? People may be shocked that at a climate summit, some of the countries are raising the issue of trans people. What does that have to do with climate change? But give us a broad overview.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you generally for your commitment to independent journalism, which is so critical in this moment. I'd say in the last 24 hours, we've seen an intensification of negotiations between states, largely behind closed doors, around what are really the big ticket items here, and arguably the big ticket items at every COP: finance, fossil fuels, and forests. So this is about the drivers of the climate crisis and the resources and finance needed to not only address mitigation of those drivers, but to respond to adaptation needs, to help communities that are suffering disproportionately from this crisis, and to deliver reparation for loss and damage. So those issues are front and center and are highly contentious, because this is a justice package that's being negotiated here. A just transition can't move forward without adequate financing from public sources, without creating new debt for the countries that are really on the front lines of this crisis. So the big polluters need to phase out and pay up. And those are some of the issues that are at the center of the debates now.
And the fact that this issue of the definition of men and women is being raised at a climate summit, is that just being thrown in to really muck up the works and not arrive at a final resolution?
We've seen no end to the kind of procedural tactics that some countries will use to really derail the talks and avoid a phase out of the fossil fuel era, to avoid responsibility for the contribution of large polluters to and the biggest fossil fuel producers to this crisis. And we're seeing the weaponization of issues, attacks on human rights, including on the very notion of gender, pushback on references to law and legal obligation that are really shocking, but are a part and parcel of a global trend towards regression away from the basic dignity and respect for human rights of communities around the world, including of indigenous peoples, who we've seen in full force here at this COP in the Amazon.
Well, Nikki, as you mentioned, one of the key issues here, as indeed at every COP, is of fossil fuels. And now there's been a push by more than 80 countries to formulate a roadmap to phase out fossil fuels. The countries include Germany, the UK, Sweden, Ireland, and Kenya. Of course, Saudi Arabia and Russia have consistently over the years objected to coming up with such a roadmap. And the U.S. is simply absent. So if you could comment on that, the absence of the U.S. and what this push means by more than 80 countries.
Sure. Well, I think the fact that we see 80 countries speaking out about the need for a roadmap away from fossil fuels is a testament to the clarity of the science, the law, and the effectiveness of political pressure and the movement for climate justice. This issue is front and center, and undeniably, we cannot solve the climate crisis without ending the fossil fuel era, without tackling its root causes. So we see countries making those statements, but we need to go beyond political declarations. And that's why it's so important that we have leadership from countries like Colombia, a producing country, fossil fuel producer in the global south, that's committed now to hosting the first international conference on fossil fuel phase out outside of these halls, precisely because we see this continued procedural obstructionism from those countries that have a vested interest in the current status quo of fossil fuel dependence. We've seen them pull out all the procedural stops to really derail the talks here, as you said.
And of course, it's Brazil. It's taking place in Brazil, another oil-rich country. And the significance of that and what the president, Lula, both Lula and Petro are targets of President Trump, what Lula is committed to right now, what he's willing to do and what not.
It's a great point, because we saw just weeks before this COP opened that there was an approval of new licenses for offshore oil and gas at the mouth of the Amazon, right offshore. And so there are contradictions here. Unless we halt oil and gas extraction, we can't fight this crisis. But we see leadership from countries like Colombia and others that are committed to pursuing real concrete action, not just declarations here, but actually taking steps to phase out 1.5 in line with equity, beginning by halting expansion of fossil fuels and charting a pathway that provides resources to bring the rest of the world along.
I mean, I guess the crucial question is, when countries as powerful and indeed the largest historic emitter, the United States, right, are absent, on top of which the world's largest oil exporter, Saudi Arabia, and the largest present emitter, China, yeah, if these countries aren't willing to go in and agree to what the terms are of negotiating a roadmap, it's not even a final document, a roadmap to the phasing out of fossil fuels, what incentive do other countries have to sign on?
Well, countries have an incentive because the future is not fossil. They know that, like Colombia as a fossil fuel producing country, recognizes that its own economic interests and its people are not don't lie with fossil fuels. And so they have options to go outside of this process, where we see the same obstructionist countries blocking progress decade after decade. And so that's why they're hosting a conference and working behind initiatives like the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty, a fossil fuel treaty that could actually bring a coalition of the willing countries together to start and build from there. Because actually transitioning away from fossil fuels and taking the lead is in the benefit of those countries and their populations. It's actually an upside.
Let's talk about climate refugees. Mm. This is your specialty. Talk about the crisis in the world today. The hundreds of millions of people who are fleeing their countries because of a climate-related issue, and the countries they're fleeing to much more responsible for climate change, bringing down the gates.
Yes, I mean, I think the statistics on the numbers of people who are being displaced by climate-driven disaster are one of the most visible and visceral reminders of the reality and severity of the climate crisis. And the fact that this is not abstract. This is about real lives. It's about survival. It's about human rights and dignity, and ultimately about justice. So this is also a reminder of two things. One, that we cannot tackle climate change without addressing its root causes, and that we absolutely need to provide finance to those countries where they're suffering disproportionately the impacts of climate change, but have not contributed to it. So developed countries need to pay up, get that adaptation finance to those countries, and support communities to build resilience and stay in their homes. And when they do have to migrate due to floods, droughts, extreme weather, heat waves, that they are received with dignity and their human rights are respected. That is utterly critical, and the law requires it. The International Court of Justice, the highest court in the world, has pronounced that. The principle of non-refoulement applies. That means that countries cannot send people back to places where they would be at grave risk of danger, including from climate harm. So this is a reminder that what we don't need is a militarized response. We know that climate impacts compound the stressors and impacts from conflict and other violent crises. And instead of a closing of ranks, we need actually a stepping up of respect for rights and finance to the country so that they can build their resilience to resist the impacts of climate change around the world.
And in fact, this report only, is that correct, speaks about refugees as opposed to internally displaced people displaced within their own borders, which I imagine would be a larger number.
It's my understanding that the bulk of these climate-induced migrants are actually internally displaced, and so that the impacts, it's in many ways a myth that the impacts are falling first and foremost on the developed world, because actually the bulk of this migration is happening within countries and between developing countries that are already facing many stressors, including from conflict and resource constraints. So we need to step up the commitments to supporting those who are only going to grow in number as the climate crisis worsens, unless there is concrete action here to address the root causes, fossil fuels, deforestation. We need to phase them out, to stop cutting trees down, and to build up finance commitments in concrete ways to tackle this at the source. Otherwise, we're just going to see more devastation and damage.
So, Nikki, before we conclude, just on another topic, the landmark decision taken by the International Court of Justice in July, the obligations of states under international law on the question of climate change.
This is the first COP after a historic decision, as you say, by the world's highest court on what countries' climate obligations are, to rest any argument that the biggest polluters don't have a legal obligation. Climate action is not an opinion, it's a legal obligation. That countries have a duty under multiple sources of law, not just these climate conventions, but customary law, human rights law, to prevent climate harm and to step up action to protect human rights in the face of climate impacts. And that law is the yardstick for progress here, not what they promised last year, the year before. They will be measured against those legal obligations. And we're seeing that come into the set a new benchmark for these talks. It's high time to end the accountability gap. That ambition gap is not just about stepping up promises and pledges, but committing to action in line with law and science.
Nikki Reich is director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for International Environmental Law. Thanks so much, Nikki, for joining us. Coming up, as climate negotiations continue here in Belém, Brazil, we speak to Sonia Guajajara, Brazil's first Indigenous Peoples Minister. Stay with us.
Recoge solo tus ideas, levanta apaga tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
El día que amanece lento, recoge solo tus ideas, levanta apaga tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega, el tiempo que flota en el aire, las horas al viento se entrega.
Llamando.
Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega, el tiempo que flota en el aire y el viento se entrega.
Me está llamando.
De a poco te zapas del miedo, un dedo tras otro lo sueltan, en tu pecho una llamarada que por dentro quema.
Me está llamando.
De a poco te zapas del miedo, un dedo tras otro lo suelta, en tu pecho una llamarada que todo lo quema.
Me está llamando.
Te está llamando. Óyelo.
Me está llamando.
Un fuego que todo lo quema, un fuego que todo lo quema. Responde que te está llamando, responde que te está llamando.
Está llamando.
Un fuego que por donde quema, un fuego que todo lo quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema.
Sound system at our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit. That's COP30 in the Brazilian city of Belém, the gateway to the Amazon. On Wednesday, I sat down with Brazil's First Minister of Indigenous Peoples, Sonia Guajajara. Democracy Now! Last spoke to her in 2023 when the UAE hosted the climate talks in Dubai. We're now in her home country. We're here with Brazil's first minister of indigenous peoples, lifelong leader of the Brazilian indigenous rights movement, a member of the Guajajara community, whose traditional homeland sits in the northeast of Brazil. It was established, the minister of indigenous peoples, under President Lula in 2023. Today, the Minister Guajajara, is here in Belém, and we're in the last days of this conference. It's an honor to speak to you again. Minister Guajajara, what are you hoping to get out of COP30?
Bom, acho que nós conseguimos já...